ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Music by Thomas Meadowcroft, that's from his recent piece, Love Songs Without Subjects. We'll be talking to Thomas later on today's show and how he turned to Lacan for inspiration for this work. And we'll also be talking about sound effects because he has written a concerto for Foley and orchestra. The poet Aja Monet has just released her second album, and it's strong stuff. She's not just a poet, she's very much a performance poet, and she performs to the extent that the performances turn themselves into music. Hard to pigeonhole, but she's going to be at the Melbourne International Jazz Festival in October, so that gives you some sort of an idea. Let's listen to the opening track, very much a statement of intent, before we talk to the poet herself. This is Say It With Your Chest.
Say it with your chest. Whatever touches your heart. Feed, fuel, fight for it. Flower, hue, hold. Help, have, honor it. Whatever touches your heart.
Whatever.
Promise, hope, hell, and high water. Wade with it. Shield. Protect. Keep it sacred.
Say it.
Whatever.
Say it.
Whatever.
Say it.
Ever what?
With your chest.
Whatever touches your heart. A future inevitable is hurt. Let it wind through you.
Let it wind through you.
Be fiercely undone. Brave and bellowing. Elbow. Ankle, shoulder your way. Will it is so. Whatever. Whatever it may be. Whatever it may be that fires the engine of your chest. Sprawls open your thoughts of you. Unminded and moved. Let it be. Let it be. Let it silly shame and show you out. Remember when before memory made you in the nameless nothing of now? Let light lead you into the darling darkness of not knowing, yet to know what it is to feel alive, living. Whatever, whatever it may be that touches your heart, whatever, that vibrating, hungry, heavy-handed heart, let it be luminous. Unleash the firefly eager to be held.
Thank you.
That's Say It With Your Chest from The Colour of Rain. It's the new album from Aja Monet, and what a pleasure to welcome you to the music show, Aja.
Thank you for having me. Grateful to be here.
That line, Say It With Your Chest, is a familiar line. What do you mean by it, and why did you take that as your starting point?
It's a poem that came out of a meditation that I had with some friends, actually musicians, several musicians, after we had done a meditation ceremony. And the refrain really was not Say It With Your Chest. The title didn't come to be until after it was written. So it started with whatever touches your heart. And I think the premise of it is to really recognize that the heart is where everything begins and ends. And so how one contends with their heart, what for me, it's all about, you know, people think it's like, Say It With Your Chest is about just speaking your mind. But really, to me, it's about moving with intention and with the courage of your heart. I see it as a piece really that makes me think about courage and how to live in that courage, how to move with that courage. And a lot of that courage shows up in the shape of our heart, how we see and move from our heart.
Yeah, well, the mind isn't in the chest, is it? But the heart is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe we talk about poetry and song and what you see as the dividing line between them, if in fact you think there is one.
I'm not sure that there's necessarily a dividing line. It's kind of like the ocean and the shore, you know. I think that there is this way that they wash up against each other and have remnants of each other within this scope of sort of our practice. For me, I find that songwriters tend to be more focused with the musical elements of the verse, right? So, but all verse, all poetry is verse, right? And all poetry has sonic, you know, is concerned with sound, is concerned with the sounds of words and how those sounds and how those symbols and within those sounds elicit meaning and depth. And I think sometimes with songwriters and songwriting, there's less concern with there necessarily being meaning as much as there is, not always, but that there can be this moment where people are really focused on the melody, you know, more concerned with the melody than the actual metaphor within it. And I think when you can merge the two, which does happen, that is kind of the real sweet spot. That's where you hope to be. But yeah, I think there is this need because of the world we live in and because of the way genres are part of how people market things, you know, there's a need to kind of categorize the crafts in this really sometimes too rigid way. But for me, poetry is the metric by which you measure all art, all creative practice. So if you were to be a good songwriter, a good cook, a good dancer, a good soccer player, whatever it is that you craft, if I were to say you do it like a poet, that automatically elicits meaning. It automatically it elevates the language of what we're talking about. So if I say you cook like a poet, I mean, you already know that there's some depth to your culinary practice, right? There's some meaning, there's some way that you approach that. And I think the same goes for songwriting, that when one approaches songwriting, you come to it with reverence for that metaphor, the personification, some of the poetic devices that help elicit meaning.
I suppose if we're talking about songwriting, I mean, with a song, if the music doesn't sound good, no one's really going to pay much attention to the words. So it's a kind of way in to the words. But in your case, writing words as a poet, I wonder whether you've ever been driven by the sound, whether the sound of the words helps you find the right word.
Well, I'd argue that no one listens to a poem if it doesn't sound good either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that part of what guides me is the sounds. And I think what we learned from the beat generation and from the African, you know, tradition of oral storytelling, that a lot of the way we approach our poetry and our storytelling is from a receptivity to sound, a relationship to the fact that words are merely symbols of sound, that before we made a word, there was an effort to communicate across difference, across misunderstanding, across kind of disconnection. And in that effort to communicate, in that effort, in that longing, in that yearning to express, we find sounds, we find ourselves making sounds. I think the difference about poetry is that there is more precision involved, there's more intention involved in carving out and sculpting those sounds into sense, you know, into some sort of sensory experience. And so it elevates the sounds into a way that allows the body to translate these ideas, these kind of deep emotions, these deep feelings that we all experience: grief, loss, joy, belonging, longing, all of these deep emotions that sometimes we're searching for the sounds, we're seeking, and we don't know where the sounds are. We're trying to make sense of that wail, of that giggle, if you know, of the textures of our lives. We're trying to, in some way, communicate them and share them and express them. I think poetry is, you know, poets often take on the the not so easy pursuit of that. You know, we find ourselves in this place where you are obsessed and sort of you muddy your days with contemplating how to communicate those expressions, and those expressions are rooted in some kind of sound that feels right, you know, that resonates. I think resonance is a big part of it. You know, the goal is to resonate. When you're really starting, you're not really thinking too much about whether or not it's going to make sense to somebody else, to be fair. You know, you're trying to be authentic to the experience and to the moment you're communicating. So I think that's usually where one starts. And eventually you get to the point where you find yourself, like, at least for me, I find myself being like, huh, does anyone else feel this way? I feel like this. You know, there's this way that you move from that compels you to search for words, to search for sounds. And sometimes words aren't enough. You know, sometimes they don't do it. They don't cut it.
On today's music show, I'm talking to poet Aja Monet about her latest album, The Color of Rain. It's interesting what you say about sometimes words aren't enough. I mean, anybody listening to your album would probably come to that conclusion that you have already thought that. But when you are writing a poem, at what point do you know that this is going to be something that you will perform with music, or is that always in the background?
I never see it as, you know, it's interesting because people see it as separate, but I don't think that anyone's, to me, the poem is sheet music. What the purpose of the page is to guide the speaker, you know, to guide the poet on how to recite the words. And to experience the words, but you can experience them in many ways, you know, because even if you're in a room with what people would presume is silence, there's a resonance, you know, there's music in the air, there's music in the way that we live, there's music in the way we're communicating right now. I think if we saw every conversation as music, we would drastically shift the entire, you know, course of history by way of pursuing each other as music, you know. I think there's more room for understanding it, that every interaction is an opportunity for composition, you know, for us to compose something entirely new. And so I think that that's the same with a poem. I think when you spend time with poetry or any art, you know, for that matter, you can have your own idea of how it's supposed to be experienced. But I think the great thing about art is that if it's good, it allows us, or if it's effective, I wouldn't even say good. I think that's a very lazy term. But I think if it's effective, it gets us at a place where we can see possibilities through it, where it opens up avenues of that we didn't see before. And so I think, like, when a poem is strong, I mean, you hear music, you know, you see paint, you see visuals, you know, you feel things in your body. So I think that there's this multi-sensory aspect where if I'm compelled, if I'm sitting with someone who is playing an instrument and I have something that I wrote, I'm gonna, and we're both vibing, you know, we're gonna sit and I'll try my shot at reciting over it. But precisely because I think every page, every poem is musical, you know, because I don't think that what we're doing is not, there's meter, there's, you know, the syllables, those are beats, those are breaths. It's all music. It's just a different way of approaching it, you know, or thinking about it. I think it has these symbols of words. Words are just these, like, symbols of sound. And we hold so much meaning, and we often use them as a means to an end. You know, people usually use them in a very transactional way, but I think there's so much possibility in one word, you know, in the sound of one word, and all that can be brought out of it when we really sing words, when we really say words with intention and with curiosity, you know, with exploration, with a room to experiment. We could all hear me say love, and love has a million different interpretations based off of just how it's said and what breath is poured into it. And I think that's music.
So in the studio, Aja, are you, as you say, vibing? Is that how it happens? You are there with musicians, some great collaborators on this new album. And do you simply try things out until you find it?
Yeah, I think, well, some songs happen in different ways. Like, there's not a formula. It doesn't have this thing called art, you know, it doesn't really work with formulas or even plans. I think the way that it works best is when one shows up to the room fully with their gifts, and each of us are present, and we see what we got, you know, we see what we're coming into the room with. But for me, the way that it has worked with this record, specifically with A Color of Rain and the record prior, was that there were poems before the music was ever made, you know, or quote unquote, the collaboration of the musicians and the instrumentation was made with the poems. But I would say that the music of the poetry was there. I wrote a lot of the poems before. There was no, the experience by which I approach music isn't one such that is similar to, like, how, you know, most songwriters or most, you know, rappers, et cetera, like, approach a song where they have a producer and they give them a track and then you just spend a bunch of time with the track and you recite and write something to the track. I think that's not our experience, if that's what you're asking. Most of the time, the poems were formed before, and or we're collaborating in real time with each other, and I will improvise the words or the sounds that come to me in the moment. But all of the poems, from what I now think when I'm speaking to you, and I'm trying to remember each track, all of them were made with the poem first, except for probably I Know That I Don't Know, which was kind of the funny part about it, right? Is that the whole purpose of that song is for none of us to know what we're doing, and to kind of go into it without knowing, without any, you know, without anything beforehand.
The letters we searched for within are stumbling. The sound of stumbling, falling, or fumbling. Missed notes. Confused cues. A place where we are swaying and swinging. No one really.
But all the poems from the record before, When the Poems Do What They Do, my first record, were all written and performed and lived in my body and in the world before I came to work with the musicians. And I think that's important to me. And it was important to Michelle as well. And that was a big thing for her, Michelle and Ndegeocello, who's helped produce this record along with Justin Brown, was that the poems were supposed to be the focal point, that the music, the instrumentation and the musicians were to respond to and engage with the words in an intentional way.
So when you are in the studio, you go into the studio, you've written these poems, you've recited them, you've performed them for audiences, and there is Michelle Ndegeocello with her bass and drummer Justin Brown. And do they have to kind of match your performance, or does your performance bend to them to some degree in some cases?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? Because, for example, Hollyweird, I mean, the beauty of what I love about this album is that so much of it is so wide ranging in terms of the experimentation and the sounds, you know, and what's happening in the music is it's not all one specific genre, one specific rhythm, or one specific tone. I think that the each song has its own life and its own references or musical references. And so, you know, Say It With Your Chest is completely different from Withness, which is completely different from Elsewhere, which is very different from Hollyweird. And then you have something like For the Congo, where that song, what the poem felt was that it was demanding for it to be just drum and voice. And so we went back to the basics with that particular poem.
This is the war my favorite poet warned me about. The one between me and me. The slow drag.
And you know, that elicits a certain kind of experience as from the Black radical tradition, but the African tradition just being voice, poetry, and the drums, there's something that happens there, the chanting that happens in the background as well. Hollyweird, for example, is completely, you know, was prompted by me sharing the poem with Michelle having known about the poem. And it was really at that time called the Los Angeles poem, because it was after the fires that I wrote that poem. And she went into the room and told everyone the exact time signature that she felt for the song and the exact energy. And she really described it as a kind of like this grungy, dodgy, you know, bar in the UK, and, you know, a dim lit bar in the UK. And we're going to go in there and we're about to, you know, rock out. And we went into the booth with that sort of energy, you know, with that prompt in particular for Hollyweird. But then there's something like Skin Folk where, you know, that was created. The poem was already alive, and me and my partner, we made a demo and we played around with, you know, these sounds in the studio. And then I recited, you know, I had shared the poem, and then we recited the poem again over together. And that was more intimate, and it was felt like, you know, you're kind of close to the ear. So I think that each poem has a different, elicits sort of a different response. And Every Media Minute and Hollyweird were the, if I can think offhand right now, maybe Elsewhere. But I know for sure Hollyweird and Every Media Minute were done in real time, the first take. There is no other take of Hollyweird.
I'm very surprised. That's fantastic. Listen, there's so many things I would have liked to ask you about, but we're nearly out of time. But I would finally like to ask about your voice as an instrument, because that's what happens to it in this context, apart from anything else, apart from the poetry, and how you use it, and whether you have maybe even models of in mind, precursors, when you use your voice in the studio.
I guess, you know, yes, I think I've been inspired by so many great poets and vocalists over the years. You know, if I would have had my way, like Nina Simone once said, you know, I would have been not a killer, but a singer, you know, if I could truly convey the spectrum, you know, of my longing that I feel at times when I hear certain people sing and I hear certain musicians wail out their hearts, you know, like the vocal abilities that I'm deeply moved by and that I admire are from some of the greatest vocalists and I would say singers, what we say, you know, back home, singers, people who just don't sing, they sang, you know, they do something else to a song that it could never have been done before with or without them. You know, I mean, like Whitney Houston is someone that like there's no denying, you know. Singing is everything after her is marked by that voice. You know, that's just like there's just certain voices that compel you, that move you, that bring the hair on your arms, you know, stand, make the hair on your arms stand. And I think that from the time I was a little girl, my voice was something that was always mentioned and commented on. And I come from a family of strong voices. Like all of the people in my family have very animated voices, are very like, you know, textured, and they have wit and gravel and breath and breeze and wind and water, and you know, all these elements show up in their voice when you hear them speaking. And so I think that that is a big part of my experience, you know, having grown up in the family that I've grown up in. But the greatest poets that I love, I mean, you think about Jane Cortez, Amiri Baraka, Sonia Sanchez, Sekou Sundiata, some of the people I often refer to, they recognize that there was Entezaki Shange, that there was something with language and sound and the voice, and that when we merged all of these things intentionally, we could transcend, you know, the very thing that we're doing. And so I think that's the hope, that's the pursuit. But the voice is what I, you know, I'm so grateful for having a voice. Let's just say that. But I'm fascinated by strong voices, you know, and also like really subtle, just the spectrum of what a voice can do. You know it in your mom and in your sister and your loved one, like when they speak to you with certain kind of tenderness or whisper or a shout, you know, those are all things that really, what a gift for us to have those cues. Those are that is. To me, emotional intelligence. I think the voice holds a great deal of emotional intelligence. It's something that I treasure, especially in light of people trying to mimic the human voice through artificial intelligence. I think the emotional intelligence that we have, that we hold in a voice, is so powerful, and I revere it.
Aja Monet, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for being my guest on The Music Show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for listening.
We've heard a lot about it, so I think we must finish with Holly Weird and a strong language warning for this one. And as you're listening, just remember that this was done in a single take.
Closets. Can a millionaire be homeless? All of a sudden, we know the meaning of community. All of a sudden, the spirit of giving is in the air. The people kindle around the flame. Nothing like disaster to shock a heart into beating. The feel-good volunteers did Reiki before they dropped off outfits for people with no events to attend. Skid Row knows how to read the room less. The undocumented avoid handouts framed in the halls of fascism. To be on house arrest with no house, just arrested. Everyone's worried about clean air. HEPA can't filter this corruption. Maybe, maybe socialism is on its way. Look at us. Look at us who took the breeze for granted. Running faucet of dreams, mutual aid. Octavia Butler newscasting premonitions from a gravesite in Altadena. The ghosts of consequence stain the air. What's the insurance policy for chickens coming home to roost? What's the insurance policy for chickens coming home to roost? That brings us to you. Everyone is living their life on layaway. Buy now, pay later. Kidnapped by mass ice cold-blooded agents. SOS formation bodies near the Everglades. Gullible, low frequency. No research, no risk-taking. Four drunk travelers with bloodshot eyes sip on sweating beer cans just off the corner, waiting out the downtown protest. A trans woman in burgundy crop top with yellow geometric sunglasses and an ivory umbrella shielding the sun. Sips on iced tea from her straw. The universe is universing. The tow truck tricksters try to boot the tires of the people. Pawns peddling for the state. Every job can be undone by the will of the worker who sees fit to serve a good greater than petty personal pocket delusions. Troops are everywhere. A country torn apart, doom-scrolling debris. The what can you do for me? Cash at me in my caption. Get over, get ahead. Culture, open tabs, generation in the echo chambers of greed. A bunch of individuals who want to go viral over commentary. All caps, baby boomer text threads. No spine having niggas. Dump as doorknobs. When people show you who they are, believe them.
Holly Weird by Aja Monet from her new album, The Colour of Rain. Aja is one of the headliners at the Melbourne International Jazz Festival in October. You can find the full lineup if you go to the festival's website, and there's a link on our website. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Foley artists are the people who make the atmospheres of film. They provide what I suppose we used to call sound effects. And Hollywood Parsifals is the title of a new work for Foley artists and orchestra, actually specifically one Foley artist and one percussionist. It's just had its first performance with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. It's the work of Thomas Meadowcroft, who we've talked to before on this show, and he is back in Australia from Berlin for that performance and for performance of a recent song cycle. It's called Love Songs Without Subjects, and we're going to listen to a little of a performance by one third of Trio Medieval, who we were talking to another third recently. This is Dieter Marie Brein with Asamisimasa.
Love.
That's some of Love Songs Without Subjects. We heard Dita Marie Bryan with Asimisimasa and Thomas Meadowcroft, who is the composer of the music, on Roland Juno 106 synthesizer. Thomas, welcome back to the music show.
Thanks for having me, Andy. Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about the start of this piece, which is Lacan. A quote from Lacan. Who is Lacan? What's the quote?
Lacan is a French philosopher and psychoanalyst. And I don't want to bog us down here on how Lacan extended the work of Freud, but the quote that I used is, love is to give something that you don't have to someone who doesn't want it.
Oh, that's quite nice. That's a bit of a conundrum.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't think of love as a lack that is then going to be fulfilled by what you find in the other, is basically what's going on there.
I see, yes. So how did that inspire you to make music? Because I get the impression there was a sort of light bulb going off.
Well, in Lacan, there's a lot of talking about love and writing about love and writing and talking about the making of love, but there's not a lot of singing of love in Lacan. So I thought this was an opportunity to actually do something relatively perverse and set him like I was setting T.S. Eliot or something like that.
Yeah. But there's also a kind of musical, you could almost strip out the word love and put music into his quote, and it would be interesting, wouldn't it?
I hadn't thought of that angle, but yes, as a composer, I suppose those two things are interchangeable.
There's an awful lot of music about love, and an awful lot of music which sets texts that are about love in music, in every genre, in every nationality, in every bit of history. So what was your approach here?
Well, you know, I really like the early 70s records of John Lennon, but I always loathed All You Need Is Love because it's not quite enough, which is getting back to the concept of lack in Lacan. And in this piece, I have small quotes or references to love songs, but they're kind of free-floating and they often appear in the piece in parallel, which creates a certain kind of friction in the memory. So you'll have things like Michelle by Paul McCartney clashing with Irving Berlin's Blue Skies, and this idea of two memories simultaneously appealed to me, and it seemed they're like kind of free-floating objects.
And how do you stitch them together? Because the piece is sort of continuous, isn't it?
Well, the piece is based on a compositional device called the chromatic bass lament, which I think first shows up in Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas right at the end in Dido's Lament. And this compositional device shows up in various love songs, and in particular in the work of Mr. McCartney and Mr. Lennon. And I sort of stretched it over 42 minutes. It appears several times in several keys, but the idea is that it's always gently falling, as if, well, the obvious thing for me is to, the obvious image is to be falling in love.
Oh, I see. Yeah. And this is also, this is the same or related to the shepherd tone effect.
Yes, well, which is a sonic illusion of something that goes down but never quite reaches its end point, and which is also kind of falling in love, but when it turns into a horror show.
So it's like an Escher staircase.
Yes. Yeah, that would be the sonic, that would be the visual image of the sonic idea, yeah.
I wonder why it is that this sort of drooping ground bass turns up so often in love music. I mean, Dido's Lament, I suppose, isn't exactly a love song, but I can hear it in my head in Michelle, for instance, the bass line in that.
Yeah, I don't know. Things going up don't sound so good. It's just basic phenomenology, perhaps, music phenomenology.
It could be that, yeah. So are we meant to recognise the quotes, the references in your song cycle?
I don't know. I mean, that's always dangerous ground. It depends on what your music background is. There's a Charlie Rich, The Most Beautiful Girl in the World shows up, but that's for country fans who are interested in country and Western music in the 70s. Blue Skies shows up, a jazz standard, but they sort of wander in and out of focus as kind of structural points in the over the 40-something minutes of the piece.
We should also talk about the piece of yours which has just happened with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, Hollywood Parsifals. First of all, I don't understand the title.
Yeah, that's what John Simpson, the Foley artist, who's one of the soloists, also said to me. And there's many ways into that. Well, Hollywood is a place and also an industry, yeah, and also a mythic place. Parsifal is based on the opera is a reference to the opera of Wagner.
Yeah.
Which is the story of Parsifal, the heroic fool, who is in search of the Holy Grail, purportedly to be the cup from which Jesus drank from at the Last Supper. And Wagner's Parsifal is based on a 13th century book, German book, by a knight and a composer, Wolfram von Eschenbach. And funnily enough, there's a whole bunch of strange connections for me there and hopefully for listeners, because if your listeners remember or have seen Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail, Sean Connery and Harrison Ford are also on the search for the Holy Grail as well, the same thing that Parsifal is looking for. And there's a whole bunch of connections between the theatrical and specifically musical theatrical tropes of Wagner that in the 1880s or late 19th century Germany that end up, strangely enough, in Hollywood by the 1930s. And Hollywood Parsifals is a concerto for sound effects artists, or Foley artists specifically, and a symphony orchestra. And it's about making the machinery of Hollywood theatre apparent in the concert hall setting.
Right. Now,
sorry, that's a lot of stuff.
But no. It is. I'm still not completely sure about the plural on Parsifal.
Oh, that's John Simpson and the excellent percussionist Eugene Ugetti. They're the two guys out the front.
Oh, they are the
They're in search of their own holy grails.
They're the holy fools. Yes,
well,
I see.
Well, in a way, because they're in search of their own holy grails. Eugene is always on the lookout for the most beautiful sound out of the strangest object. And John is also on the search for sounds out of objects. So in a way, they're in search of their own holy grails.
I see. It's pretty recherché, but I do understand it now.
It's somewhat convoluted, but... there is a Wagner quote in the piece straight up front. There's the Grail quote from the Parsifal straight up front. You get it. There's no mystery. Okay. There's no quest. It's like, here's a Grail quote. See you later.
Right. You don't have to look any further.
No, don't go looking. It's there. See you. And it happens twice. So it's got an original and a knockoff.
Right. Now, the last time we spoke, I think, on this show, it was news themes, TV news themes that you had turned into a very grand orchestral work. And I wonder whether there's a... I could ask a sort of general question about what it is that attracts you to, well, things like news themes and sound effects, which are, in a way, you know, the accoutrements of popular culture.
Yeah, what interests me about writing for orchestra as a composer is how the orchestra works in the popular imagination. I mean, the orchestra is like Test cricket or the royal family. It's always constantly in danger of dying, but it will live on permanently because of that, and that's a good thing, yeah? And that orchestras need to reach out to audiences, and yes, that's true. It's hard to get the kids to come and listen to Brahms 3, but on the other hand, we're also completely saturated and permeated by orchestral music through video games and film, and a very specific type of orchestral music that's happened in the last 60 years. The key proponent of that being John Williams, the composer who did all the Star Wars soundtracks, etc., which is also a reference to 1930s golden age Hollywood, Franz Waxman, Korngold, and so on and so on. And there's an understanding of orchestral music in the popular imagination, but it is not the understanding of modernist music, say, of Boulez or Stockhausen, but of a very much a sort of post-Viennese symphonic tradition. But it's a thing. It's a thing in pop culture. And that's kind of what I'm engaging with.
And are you engaging in the spirit of critique or celebration, or are you not making a distinction?
Maybe that's what makes my work contemporary. There's a kind of convenient ambivalence part of it. I mean, I personally, like for the Hollywood Parsifals, I deeply enjoyed making a series of music cues that it has to reference certain things, right? It has to be, it has to have a kind of relatively quickly intelligible language and style so people can locate where they are in the piece. So for example, the Western, there's a bunch of Morricone references. In the restaurant scene of the love section, there's some Mancini, there's some Gil Evans orchestra, there's some Gil Evans voicings and so on. So I really enjoy that aspect. I mean, it's kind of cultural critique with some perverted pleasure involved.
Yes.
Oh, God, that sounds so highfalutin. Maybe I have to...
No, well, again, we started with Lacan.
Yeah. Oh, back to perversion, you see.
Tell me, just briefly before we finish, about Berlin. You're still based in Berlin.
Yes.
How is that?
You want to know about grocery prices or rent or music?
Well, if you like, but I was just thinking about in terms of career, making a career in Berlin as an Australian composer, writing, as it seems, very often for Norwegian performers.
I have had the great fortune to work with arranging the music of Herbert Grönemeyer, who would not be known necessarily to Australians, but I describe him to my family and friends as the German Jimmy Barnes or the German Bruce Springsteen. And I arranged an opera for him, and I'm still doing some work for him. And this has been a kind of interesting parallel in relation to my practice doing stranger stuff, experimental music and so on. I'm still working. I mean, I'm earning a living wage. Just doing composition commissions. And I think there's a Bob Dylan quote about that, like any man who can get through the day and go to bed doing what he wanted to do is a success. I don't know how that translates financially. but yeah, and but in terms of Berlin, I mean, I use it quite differently now. My partner is loves opera, so I know we have three opera houses on the main street, so I go to the opera.
Right.
It would have been different. I probably would have used the city differently when we last spoke 10 years ago.
Yeah. Right?
So, but this is the nature of aging.
Well, maybe there's an opera coming up. I mean, you're sort of halfway there with Hollywood Parsifals, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I guess it's the next step in the growth model.
I think it is. I think it is. Thomas Meadowcroft, thank you very much indeed for joining me again on The Music Show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Part of Hollywood Parsifals, we heard the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Northey, and soloists John Simpson on Foley and Eugene Ughetti on percussion. Music by Thomas Meadowcroft. And Thomas's other piece, Love Songs Without Subjects, is performed by Rubik's Collective on August the 25th at the Melbourne Recital Centre. The Music Show is produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham. Technical production this week from Harvey O'Sullivan. And the show is made on Gadigal, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. Coming up, the Persian-Australian tar player Hamed Sadeh bringing jazz voices and Middle Eastern virtuosity together.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.